That, of course, was Roxy Music. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, a monthly show devoted to the creative life. Usually interviews with artists and writers, but something a little different this week, a recorded talk by Jose Reisig, a meditation teacher from Rhinebeck. We now have a choice of places to go meditate, those who are so inclined, a Tendai Dharma Center in Canaan, Japanese school, the Ivam Institute in Ghent, which was founded by a Tibetan Lama, the late Traleg Rinpoche, the One Dharma Center in Claverick on Route 23, which welcomes everybody on Saturday mornings to their beautiful meditation hall overlooking the Catskills, and weekly sittings with Mr. Reisig and his wife Raquel in Rhinebeck. The talk is entitled Our Money or Our Life, based on a Jack Benny joke. After the talk, three excerpts from the score for Surviving Picasso by Richard Robbins, who died recently from Parkinson's, age of 71. He wrote the scores for practically every Merchant Ivory movie after 1975. Did a few performances at TSL, collaborations with Claudia Bruce, Stations of the Cross collaboration with his partner, the visual artist Michael Schell, and well-loved here and abroad. After the Robbins, a beautiful rendition of Nature Boy by Joe Pass and Ella Fitzgerald. Enjoy.
Today's talk is meant to connect our practice on the cushion with our practice of daily life. I'm going to start with daily life and then make the connection with our ordinary practice. Our practice of meditation. That's what I meant. The title of today's talk, appropriately then, is Our Money or Our Life. So, you see, in daily life, that's what the talk starts talking about, in daily life, when you're told your money or your life, you know, there's a bandit saying that who is ready to rob you and gives you an alternative. Do you want to keep your money or keep your life? And of course, most of us would hand our money out without hesitation. In the course of our regular life, we often confront similar dilemmas. Not in the process of being mugged, but in having to choose between our income, that is our money, or the quality of our life. And when confronted with that dilemma, lo and behold, more often than not, what we choose is to retain our money and surrender our life. It's incredible. What makes us do that? I'm not saying it's universal, but it's quite common. Today I'll try to answer that question in the light of the split we have created between money and wisdom. And I will examine what it'd be like, with the help of the practice, meditation practice, to overcome this dilemma. Let me make this very clear, patently clear. We inhabit a world that is split into two presumably incompatible spheres. The sphere of money on the one hand, and the sphere of morality and wisdom on the other. The rules of the world of money have nothing to do with wisdom and morality. In the money world, all that matters is what's called the bottom line. As we add our assets and we add our debts, is there a positive, and how large a positive balance is there? That's called the bottom line. And so, wisdom and morality are confined to a world that's not ruled by money. This separation, of course, has been around for quite a long time. The Buddha expressed his concern about this when talking about right livelihood, and he very clearly and unquestionably prescribed that dealing in arms, slaves, prostitution, or drugs is against the principles of morality and should be abandoned. Jesus expressed similar concern when he drove the money changers out of the temple. But neither Jesus nor the Buddha could have imagined the disconnect between the two worlds that exists in our time. Let me illustrate it. This is not a theory. This is something quite experiential. Let me illustrate it with a couple of stories. One is a story from the 1890s in New York City. At that time, more so than today, of course, it can happen, but not with the intensity that it happened then, there were several New York City hostesses who competed with each other to be the rage of the elite. One significant item in the scorecard when they invited guests was the presents they gave to their guests. Often jewelry inside the folded napkins as they set the table. One particular hostess, determined to outdo her rivals, placed instead of jewelry crisp $100 bills. I mean, a huge sum at the time. Her gimmick backfired. Nobody of any consequence ever accepted her invitations again. Why? She had transgressed the forbidden boundary between the world of money and that of morality. And here's a follow-up of this story. A few months ago, with Raquel, we had some guests, four guests in fact, for lunch. We were sitting in the screen porch of our home, and I told them this story. And then I went to make some tea. And when I came back, as you can probably imagine, I found a $20 bill in my napkin. Now, what's interesting here, you see, He said, it wasn't easy for me to take those $20. Because, I mean, they were breaking a rule, sure, but I would be breaking a rule accepting it. I did accept it, of course. I had the intellectual understanding to accept it. But I had this difficulty inside me. The separation is so deeply ingrained that reason doesn't do away with it. The second story concerns a money workshop I attended in London, led by a California philosopher called Jacob Needleman. It took several days, and one morning we were asked to contribute some money to a kitty. And then Needleman asked for volunteers to hand out the money to strangers. I was one of the volunteers, and each one of us got £20, actually. It wasn't dollars, pounds. And then after the lunch break, we'd come back and share the stories. I don't remember the other stories. They're all vivid, but I remember mine, of course. So I stood there in this busy corner of London, looking for some target for my investigation. And I settled on a young couple. They were waiting for the light to turn to cross the street, and I stopped them and I explained them that I wanted to test this out. What was it like to give money to strangers? Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention. We excluded in the strangers that we'd give money to beggars, prostitutes, organized charities, and even street vendors, because they're used to deal with money. I mean, it had to be something that was not permissible, that was sort of breaking the rules. So the young guy listened with interest. Yeah, he understood I was doing a test. The girl with him was absolutely furious. She was so frightened that I would accept the money. I mean, she couldn't conceive this breaking of the rules. In the end, he took it. They crossed the street and I saw them arguing with each other as far as I could see them. The only other story I remember was of a friend of mine in that group. And what he reported is that he could not bring himself to give out the £20. Now, you see, if we had been handing out flowers, no problem. So, the partition is real, it's not a formality, it's in our minds. In order to better illustrate this partition, this charade of a partition between the money and the morality spheres, I've constructed the mock-up of the wall. That's supposed to be the wall. Some of you may stand up if you don't see it, but there's an aluminum foil there, unfolded. The sheet delimits two areas. On this side of the sheet, say, it's a moral area where family, friends, and the family of us too, the Sangha, belong. On the other side, let's say the side towards the wall here, but of course it's the whole world. It's the whole world. Everybody else. Everybody else is strangers in the world. On that side, the only rules that apply are the rules of the market, the dictates of the bottom line, the logic of money. In crossing to the other side, we are prompted, expected to become our greedy selves, to not go around handing out 20-pound bills to strangers. In this partition, it's not a theoretical, it's one that we experience. So I've constructed a number of posters that I'm going to put on the wall just to illustrate the ways in which our world is cut in two halves. The first poster I have already shared with you. This is ad from the chemical bank that I shared with you yesterday. Beyond the wall, everything is under control. On this side of the wall, it's our ordinary lives, the full catastrophe of our ordinary lives. This, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, this audio tape, well, it's an audio tape, I suppose, reflects our messy life, you know. Real life. There are all kinds of things that are not fitting into place sometimes. Sometimes very many, sometimes few, it doesn't matter. And the bank, the money world, on the other hand, offers us a neat, laundered CD, as in contrast to that. Of course, as I mentioned yesterday, and it's obvious to all of us in these times, this thing can get really messy, the banking side. And when it gets really messy, it's hopeless. Well, here, the mess we can deal with. So let me post the posters. Another illustration. Family and friends on this side, as I said, strangers on the other side. On the other side, we transact business. On this side, we cultivate relationships. And an illustration is a sign I saw in a shop, well, decades ago, but I still remember it. I wrote it down. A shop in a little village in Ecuador. The village is called Macas. And it was in Spanish, of course. I'll say it in English and then repeat the Spanish version, the original. In English, it would say, "Dear customer, do not confuse friendship with business." You see, everybody was friendly in that town. This guy, I understand it. He was fed up with people, you know, "I'm a friend, come on, I'll pay you tomorrow," kind of thing. You know? I mean, it's understandable, but it fits. In Spanish, it's "Señor cliente, no confunda la amistad con los negocios." I'll leave those signs there in case you want to examine them. Money side, legality. Moral side, morality. There's a quote, again from decades ago, that I picked from a newspaper in England during the Mexican debt crisis, remember? There was gatherings to... Same thing that's happening now with Greece was happening with Mexico. And this people from corporations, representatives of corporations, were gathering with the representatives of a Mexican government to see if they could strike a deal. And the corporate guy says, and I quote exactly his words, says, "We are simply protecting the interests of our shareholders." But the Mexican debt negotiator wants to lecture us on morality. How dare him! Money side, quantity, primarily. Moral side, quality, primarily. It's a little cartoon from the New Yorker. All these prosperous-looking people gathered for dinner, I suppose, or lunch, whatever. And one of them tells the other, "Money is life's report card." I mean, it fits with our culture. That's why the New Yorker made a cartoon. Money side, presumption of scarcity. Moral side, presumption of availability. Without scarcity, you have inflation. Very different rules. Money side, competition. Moral side, cooperation. In the competition, all against each other. In the cooperation, all together. And then there is that I call it fable of Adam Smith, who said, under the title of The Invisible Hand, he said, there's an invisible hand such that the pursuit of self-interest leads to satisfaction of social interests. In the money side, sexual commerce, including marriages of convenience and prostitution. On the moral side, love relationships. I got this quote from the movie Pretty Woman, in which Richard Gere, a businessman, says to Julia Roberts, who is a prostitute, "I don't get emotionally involved in business." And Julia Roberts says, "I know. It's like turning tricks. When I'm with a guy, I just do it." And here, from a book of quotes that I've used before, this woman called Vanessa, she lives in South Africa. She says, "For me, money is very important. Money is the only thing I dream of. As I always say, if I must have a boyfriend, he must have money. I always say to men, 'No, I don't want you because you don't have any money.' And they say to me, 'You only want to love me for my money?' No," she says, "for me there is no love. I need money. If he can't give me any, I want money. I love money. I need money. For me, money is everything." Bit extreme, of course, but then not everybody speaks their mind as Vanessa. And then, of course, this partition is polarized. Between the sexes, you know, doesn't. There's a masculine side of each one of us and the feminine side of each one of us. We could call it, some writer has called it, Mars and Venus. Mars, the masculine side, and Venus, the feminine side. And there's that old nursery rhyme, English, I think. Must be, yes. Which says, the king is in the country house counting out his money. The queen is in the garden eating bread and honey. So it's an old partition. And then in more modern times, there's a visa ad. A man and a woman, and she says, well, you know, they, with visa they get all these benefits, supposedly, anyway. And she says, just the two of us alone all weekend, how romantic. And he says, if we use our Visa card, we'll earn 20% in rewards. What a deal. But again, you know, men and women have both sides, of course. A couple more. I'm not exhausting the list. Just see whether it gets you an idea that this is for real, you know. On the money side, the pursuit of profit, to avoid the erosion and the extinction of our egos. You seek profit so that the ego comes up. On the moral side, the pursuit of ecological sustainability, to avoid the erosion of habitats and the extinction of our species, of all species, including our own. And one last one. On the money side, plutocracy, that is, governed by the rich, governed by the wealthy and for the wealthy, if you wish. On this side, democracy, government by the people and for the people. So, to sum it up then, when we dwell on the monetary side of the divide, we end up imprisoned by it. But what takes us to play on the money side is not money itself. It's not that money makes us do that. Of course not. It's our own wanting mind. A mind that is willing to shed morality and wisdom for the sake of filling up its pockets, yes, but primarily puffing up its ego. It's greedy ego. So, of course, you'd understand that there are forces trying to push this wall in both directions. From the money side, the pressure has been relentless in recent times, as the power of morality has dwindled in relationship to the power of the bottom line. We have seen the money world, the corporate world, take over our political system and even the run of our lives. The moral side has also, of course, thankfully responded in kind, trying to regain ground both in the political an economic arena. And certainly, I for one cannot but applaud those efforts to restore the balance in the distribution of power currently concentrated in the hands of the very few. And yet, the point that I want to make clear is that a lasting solution does not depend on the location of the wall, but in its being tumbled down, its demise. Let's talk about the possibility of the wall coming down. Certainly. If it did, then we could restore the rule of morality for all our interactions, not just within the friends, family, and sangha, but with all the world, and even with all parts of ourselves, you see. As I mentioned the story of how I found this $20 in my napkin, and there's a part of myself I had difficulty with that. Of course, talking about tumbling down the wall is easier said than done, absolutely. But said it must. Otherwise, unless we say it, unless we talk about the wall coming down, we remain trapped in the anticipation that there is no way out, that the world is of such a nature that will remain forever fractured into two incompatible spheres. And I say, rubbish. So, how do we keep at least reminding ourselves that there is a way out? One obvious way to do that is to come to appreciate the commons, the space of conviviality, of being together. That's already available, surely on this side of the wall, and sometimes even with people who were strangers to us. If we start cultivating conviviality, we discover that there's no need to barricade ourselves behind anything, behind any wall. For me, the recent, current, really, Occupy Wall Street movement is a case in point. True, I haven't been there, but Maya has, Raquel has, I've talked to other people who have, and of course I've been following on the TV through Amy Goodman's excellent reporting in a program called Democracy Now! And other programs as well. I've been following what's happening. And what I gather from what I've heard and seen is that it's not so much an occupation of a pre-existing space. What's happening is an opening of a new space, opening of a new space. Take, for instance, this plaza near Wall Street, park, whatever, where the demonstrators are gathered. There's space for conversation there. One person talks aloud and others repeat what they say, and that takes the place of loudspeakers. There's a sharing of food. Breaking bread, if you wish. There's doing artwork, doing body work, doing mind work, really. All kinds of activities done in common. What matters is not so much the actual details of what goes on, but that the space is opening. It's an open space. It's an open space in the street, and it hopefully will be matched by an open space inside ourselves. Because that's what the practice of meditation is about, to create an open space inside ourselves, a receptive space inside ourselves. We, in the course of practice, we set out to discover what is it like to dwell unhindered in the world, inner and outer. Of course, sometimes we do, very often in our lives and in our real interaction with others, bump into hindrances. But then, when we recognize the hindrances, this is a hindrance I bump into, then we can do something about it. We can go beyond them. When I was just starting meditation, I remember doing a week-long retreat. That was at Gaia House in England. And it was one of maybe my first week-long retreat. And I found myself during the whole week, not all the time, but much of the time, obsessing about my bank account in the U.S. I mean, afraid that I had just a few thousand dollars, you know. It's not that I was rich. But afraid that somebody would do something with that money, take it away. I mean, that taught me a lot, you know. How I had created this fiction around my bank account. A fiction like that thing there. Very much the first poster with the CD instead of the messy audio tape. Becoming aware of this obsession was an enormous gift. I could really basically diffuse a deal with it. It took me time, but I did. Transcend it. Move on. So by practicing meditation, we come to realize firsthand that the limits of our world, the shape of our world, is in the end defined by our own mind. By our own both individual and collective minds. Therefore, if the rules of money end up constraining us, is simply because we buy into them. Of course, I mean, we may have a shortage of money, but I'm talking about this psychological extension of the difficulties we may have in paying our bills. But if we don't buy into them with our hearts, then we remain free. And we pay our bills the best we can. The real problem with our money or our life is in the hour. If we cling, it's in clinging. If we cling, then we are trapped. Not by bandits, but by ourselves. But if we channel both life and money, guided by wisdom instead of greed, then we are free from the menace of the most dangerous bandit of all. Our own ego self. So, let me make this point very clear again. The problem is not money itself, not at all. It's how we relate to it. Without the collusion of our egos, this wall, will not be able to stand the impact of economic crises that visit us periodically. Crises that call into question the sanity of excluding wisdom and morality from the public sphere. Then, if and when we come to realize the insanity of the wall, as the inability of the wall to deliver happiness becomes clear for all to see, then we stop propping up the wall. And then it will inevitably fall. The actual schedule for that I leave to economists, of course, and to the ups and downs of the fortunes of the world, which are very much out of control at this point in much of the world. But at least it's important that we do not collude into the construction of that separation. So, let's sit in silence for a few minutes.
A boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very was he. And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to